This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and this is a special edition, 9/11, 20 years later. We begin with a conversation with State Representative Ed Soliday of Valparaiso. He can personally speak to the events of September 11th, 2001.
I understand that at the time of the attacks on the World Trade Center and on the Pentagon that day and everything that happened all around it, that you were working as a vice president for United Airlines. Will you talk a little bit first about your particular job at the time and then if you want, if you feel like, relating the experiences that you had after learning about all of everything happening that day?
Sure. And then if you want to pause or something, just let me know.
Okay. Go ahead.
I was vice president of safety, quality assurance, and security at United. So most of the regulatory responsibilities of the airline reported through me: environment, occupational safety, flight safety, everything from fuel to security. And we had a fairly well-respected security group, many ex-Treasury and FBI agents, plus some pretty strong operational people. And so at the time of 9/11, let me start with this. One of the things we did at United that not everyone did, we practiced emergency response 3 to 4 times a year. Pretty expensive. We would put pilots in the simulator and connect them so that we could connect our whole network. We could put 1,000 people in the field in about 2 hours if we had an accident, because the first job is take care of your customers and take care of your employees when there's an accident, but at the same time preserve all of the evidence, because the chain of custody of evidence for an accident is very rigorous. And normally we're dealing with the National Transportation Safety Board. So I also had, as part of my portfolio, management of the crisis center. We had a very high-tech crisis center. Each of the divisions had a seat that would be participants in responding to an emergency. And to have a seat in that room, you or your alternate had to be available 24/7, 365 days a year, within an hour of the crisis management center. And we held people accountable for that. So, interestingly enough, we had practiced with the FBI anthrax on an airplane about a month before.
Mm-hmm.
And our definition of success was failure. Find where we're weak and fix it. So, while I had responsibility for the crisis center, there were folks there who outranked me, but my job was coordination and so forth. So 9/11, I rarely took days off. Generally, my theory is work is more fun than fun. But I had taken a day off because my wife was going to take some friends up to the boat, and I was a little nervous, and she said she was over 21 and could handle it without me. So she got me out of the shower early in the morning, and she said, an airplane just hit the World Trade Center, and a little one. And I said, oh, give me, that can't be right. Got out, saw what was happening, got in the car. Before I got the car started, the director of security was on the phone, and he said, we are missing an airplane. And so I said, well, activate the crisis center. It's very expensive to open the crisis center, so we had a whole manual in how to open it and who got called and when they got called and what level. So I said, open the crisis center. About 5 minutes later, the executive VP, who was my direct supervisor, called, and I was an operations guy and grew up as a pilot on the line. And I said, Andy, this is what we practice for. Just follow the plan. Activate the crisis center. I'll be there and lock the campus down. So by the time I got there and got to the crisis center, which was probably 35 minutes later, everyone was in their seats. We were connected to our maintenance base in San Francisco. And pilots share responsibility with a dispatcher. Every flight has a dispatcher assigned to it. Now, dispatchers have more than one person assigned to them. But if there's a crisis, we can take that particular dispatch function into the crisis center and isolate it. So when I walked in the room, the director of security said, we've lost contact with Flight 93. And in the crisis center, the room had a number of large flat panels, and we had the capability of tracking the radar. It was a little bit of a lag, 4 minutes about. And so somewhere in that time frame, which is still debated, we decided to bring the fleet down, which is no small thing. We are able to talk to from that facility, talk to air traffic control. We can talk to the government. We can talk to about anyone we want to. But WHO and the FAA and us both claim we ordered the fleet down. The important thing is we ordered it down.
Right.
Which is not an instantaneous thing. There are things like points of no return where they can't go back to where they came from. So just recovering the fleet, we're an international carrier, and so recovering the fleet from over the Pacific and so forth is a big, pretty big challenge. So we had isolated 93's dispatch function into the crisis center, and we were not able to talk with them. Neither was ATC, neither was the air traffic controller. And we were watching on the radar, and he turned south, and then we knew that airplane had been hijacked also. And we were in communication with the state police, and they notified us of a black smoke cloud, and it was pretty obvious the plane had crashed. Some folks on the airplane had called through to our maintenance facility. They had had cell phones, and that's all a matter of record. You can read it in the 9/11 report. So we have all these airplanes up, and the FAA turned the air traffic control system over to the military. And the military really was operating on an old Scatana plan that was there in place in case there were an attack from over the pole. And we were executing plans as we had, and we had shared them with the FBI. We were pretty open. If you look, there's articles in the Wall Street Journal of Susan Carey from 20 plus years ago, where we had reporters come in and see how we practiced. So we were transparent in our planning and so forth. So about the time that we lost 93, Canada shut its airports down to us, and we couldn't land at the normal diversion stations from our international flights. So one of the dispatchers came into the crisis center and said, they're not letting us land in Anchorage, and they won't let us land in Canada. Now, later, they let us land in Canada, but
right.
Initially, everybody was trying to get their arms around it. And he said, we've got 11 airplanes in the traffic pattern up there, and the Air Force is saying, we're not going to let them land, and we've got, I think it was 3 that are down to minimum fuel. So I said, okay, get the TRACON on the phone. Let's talk to them. And so I talked to him at Anchorage, and the guy said, well, do these folks really have an emergency, or are they saying that? And I said to him, can you tell me in the book where you get to ask that question? He said, I'm out of line. I appreciate that. But he said, the general's saying nobody's going to land until he sorts this out. I said, well, I've lost 2 airplanes. I'm not going to lose 3. So you tell him from me, all the major media is one floor below me, and he and I are going to be the 2 most famous people in America. And I'm going to tell my people to go ahead and land because we can navigate without you. And he said, can I get back to you? I said, yep, but we're not going to mess with this. And I called the administrator, and she was in with Secretary Mineta. And the FAA has an administrator. That's the title, the person that's head of the FAA. Said, she's with the administrator. And so I talked to the deputy, the associate, and I said, look, I said, I'm telling these guys to land. I'm not messing with this. And you can hold me accountable. Don't hold them accountable. They're landing. And he said, I've got it. I understand.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, by the time I got off that phone call, they had decided to let the airplanes land in Anchorage. So we had, my boss was standing behind me. His background was a banker. He looked at me and he says, he looks at me and he says, you know, sometimes you even scare me. And I said, feel free to take over anytime you want to, your boss. And he went, no, you've got it. So we were just in constant back and forth. American's executive, he was vice chairman by then, Bob Baker, and I were friends, and we were talking, and what can we do? Where do we go from here? Because when you have something like this and you're bringing the fleet down, that is major stuff. Because now you've got to start planning for how you get them back up.
Right.
You don't know how many other hijackers might be out there. You're landing airplanes by now in airports that are diversionary in Canada and other places that don't have everything from food to fuel. They can handle one airplane, but when you put several in, they don't have enough ham sandwiches to handle the people on board. And at the same time, we're saying, how do we screen these airplanes to get them back in the air? So we were back and forth with Secretary Mineta and the FAA and so forth, and trying to sort out how do we get back in the air. And what's it going to look like? Is it going to be everything all at once? Are we going to do it in stages? And at the same time, that's why we have a crisis center with everybody there. We're managing the issues of the crash site at 93, in Flight 93. We had a team there, and they handle everything from funeral arrangements to interacting with the families. So forth. Generally, in our crisis management plan, if we have people that are injured, we have a person in the hospital. Each family is assigned a United member who, anything they need, we try to meet those needs. And I think if you ask around, we're pretty famous for it. The FBI took over the investigation. The NTSB was there, the NTSB said, which I'm quite proud of, the FBI guy says, what do we do now? Because they determined it was a criminal act. And the NTSB guy says, you're lucky it's United. Just let them handle it, and they'll take care of it. Now, the rules are very, very different. When the NTSB is investigating, you photograph every part, everything. The FBI is looking for criminal evidence that they can use in court. So it's a very different process, but our folks adapted and did good work out there. But we had people out of the country, all over the country, trying to get them back, senior officers trying to get them back. We brought some back by train. But generally, I slept at my desk for several days, and we just kept the crisis center open because we had interacted with the FBI in the past. They're not going to tell you what they're doing, and that's fine with us. What we want to be certain is they know what we're doing, so we don't do something that interferes with their investigation. So right. We had 20 FBI agents with their own room. So even when we went back to flying, if we had any thing that even appeared risky, we could run it by the FBI folks. We shared with them a computer expert on our computing system who went down to their offices in Chicago. Interestingly, the FBI came in at about 1 in the morning and said, is there any way you can help us get 100 agents from San Francisco to New York?
Right.
Probably. And they said, well, we were turned down by the other airlines. Now, in the heart of most pilots is the desire to be a hero. So I knew I could get a flight crew, and the senior vice president of maintenance and I were pretty good friends. So I went into the dispatch facility, and I said, I need a 757 out of San Francisco to New York. And the systems operation controller said, well, how are you going to get airways? I said, well, I'll get the airways. So the FBI got me airways, and then they came in and said, you can't do this free. You've got to pay us. So I picked a number, which will remain undisclosed.
Okay.
And about 3 o'clock or 4 o'clock in the morning, my boss came in. He said, do you have an airplane up? And I said, yeah. And I told him why. And he said, do I want to know how much you charged him? I said, probably not. He said, thanks. Let me know how it goes. And he walked out. So,
well, that's probably the best thing that the chief executive could do, you know, is to just turn it over and not even look at the ledger. So, yeah.
Well, that's why we practiced. We empower the folks that meet with the families to meet their needs. I didn't want them calling me if some family needed new tires on their car to get to where their family member was. We let them decide that. That was our agreement with the insurance company. Now, if somebody wanted a new Mercedes, we probably ought to have a chat. But Generally what families want is so mundane in the scope of the events that we don't need to decide that at the vice president level. So we empowered folks, and I don't think we ever questioned anybody's decisions in that matter. What we do is most people who call in when there's an accident will call the reservation number. Now, the NTSB said you had to create an 800 number, which we did. We learned from an accident we had before my time as VP. We got 40,000 phone calls in one day, and you have to sort them. Some are, my husband was on that plane, his ticket number was so-and-so, and immediately that person is assigned a person who they can contact 24/7 with their own phone number.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have folks who call in and say, well, my Uncle Charlie, I haven't seen him in about 4 years, but I know he travels. Can you check to see if he was on the plane? Now, we handle that call a little differently. We don't have enough employees to assign one to that, but the call still has to be managed. So we had a separate crisis center just for family assistance, run by some extremely competent people. That team between those of us who were the technical side and those who handled the family coordinated well together. We looked after one another. Just people you could depend on, so they didn't have to run and ask you every time they needed to do something. And that worked out well for us. We did send a team to New York, but there was not a lot for them to do in New York. There just wasn't much left. So, again, that's pretty much how it went. I wound up what is known as the 30B6 most knowledgeable party in the litigation that followed, which there's still one case open. My wife wants all these documents out of the basement.
I can imagine, yeah. He's taken up a lot of space, I would think so, over the years now. All right, Ed, if you will, talk about the most visible impact of the entire 9/11 disaster, and that was the crash of Flight 175 into the South Tower in New York City. Tell us the thoughts and what you, as at the time, dealing as a United Airlines vice president, had to deal with.
Yeah, Flight 175 happened quickly, very different than Flight 93. Mm-hmm. The ATC lost communication, and it hit the World Trade Center. Shortly after, American hit the World Trade Center, and shortly after that, American flew into the Pentagon. When there was a lot of confusion at the time, whose airplane was where and which airplane hit the World Trade Center, even after I got to the crisis center and was in communication with Mr. Baker at American, we were trying to decide whose airplane was where. There was even some confusion as to, in the early hours or in the early minutes, of whether it was our airplane that bounced into the Pentagon. The American didn't fly straight into the Pentagon. The guy hit the parking lot, thank heaven, which absorbed some of the energy,
right,
and then bounced in. So 175, by the time we didn't see it coming, we were trying to sort out whose airplane is what is happening, and sorting through whatever we had, air traffic tapes and so forth, whatever we could to find out what was happening. That started the trigger for when the second airplane hit, that started the triggers for us to order the fleet down, the FAA to turn the air traffic control system over to the military, and so forth. So 175 was really the triggering event. We didn't have any heads up like we did on Flight 93. And 175, the Trade Center collapsed a significant period of time after the airplane hit. So there just wasn't a lot left to do because you had this massive crash site.
You mentioned, so there's still one particular case that's still open out there 20 years later?
Yes, it's an interesting, complex case. The guy who had the lease on the World Trade Center received a significant settlement from the Port Authority, but he's continued to say to the judge he wants more from the airlines, and that's above my pay grade. I have no idea where that is. The attorneys, I still do some work for the attorneys in other accident cases. And I keep saying, can I get rid of this paper? And they say, well, it should be over, but it's not. So,
right. Yeah.
You had asked about the impact on United Airlines. I guess I think more about the people. That accident, we were... Mm-hmm. Losing $180 million a day. We laid off 20,000 people. The airline mourned. The folks kept coming to work. We had the whole facility, the executive area, world headquarters, on lockdown. And people were, even folks on the ground, were frightened. We received multiple threats of from people who thought it was cute to do that. So the airline was frightened. People were, but they functioned well, and we tried to keep as many folks working as we could, and it was a very, very difficult time for the airline.
Well, Ed Soliday, now, and thank you first for basically reliving what happened on September 11th, 2001. Now, 20 years later, what are your thoughts now as we go into this anniversary coming up?
Well, I was interviewed by CNN a few weeks after 9/11, and the American people were willing to accept security measures that I would have never recommended because they never wanted to see it happen again. And CNN asked me what I thought, because we were at a conference or some kind of a thing. And I said, my fear is that the American people will forget and how easily in a free society folks can do horrible things. People ask why we don't do what the Israelis do, because the American people won't tolerate it.
Mm-hmm.
But the concern always is that you do enough to mitigate the risk. I used to teach a class at George Washington University, an introduction to security and safety, and I would always start the class with, there is no zero, there is only risk mitigation. And one of the toughest risks to mitigate is people who are willing to die for a cause that very few folks understand. And so having risk mitigation that meets the current risk is very, very difficult. So, and as the American people are used to their freedom, and then somebody says, we'll take your shoes off, or I'm not endorsing or not endorsing taking your shoes off, they become incensed, and then government officials tend to say, well, I'm tired of answering the phone.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just hoping that with the events that are happening around the world even today, that folks will realize there are still folks out there that'll kill women and children for some cause that those women and children don't even understand. So 20 years later, I'm just hoping those folks who have taken my generation's place will remember this was horrible and ugly and could have been a whole lot worse.
State Representative Ed Soliday from Valparaiso. On 9/11, the date that we know best, September 11th, 2001, he was Vice President for Safety and other matters for United Airlines. And he's basically for us relived what happened and how United Airlines had to deal with the loss of flight number 93 and all of the circumstances surrounding it as well. And Ed, thank you for spending time going through everything again and your observations about, as to how we approach things as we are now 20 years from the anniversary. Thank you for being with us.
You bet. Thank you for the opportunity.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio.
Continuing on with our conversation centering around the 20th anniversary of the September 11th, 2001 attacks in New York City, the Pentagon, as well as in rural Pennsylvania. We have with us Purdue University Northwest Associate Professor of Political Science, Richard Rupp, to talk some thoughts, at least about the outcome that had happened and a look to the future. And Professor Rupp, thanks for joining us on the program today.
Well, thank you very much. As always, it's a pleasure to chat with you and your audience, Chris.
Well, will you give us some reflections that you have based on what we all know now, 20 years later?
I thought I would focus more on my field of expertise, which is to, professor of international relations and a focus on American foreign policy. So when I look back on the attacks on September 11th, 2001, I asked myself, what were the goals of Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda? And I think many Americans and many people around the world probably think that the primary goal was to kill as many Americans, as many civilians in a dramatic fashion in one day. I think that was an absolute goal, but I don't know if it was the primary goal. I think frankly, it was more of a tactic in service of a grander strategy. So let me share a couple of thoughts about what I'm talking about.
Okay.
See, Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda had rather grand aspirations 20, 25 years ago, and perhaps still today, but it's lessened the threat. The grand hope was to spread radical militant Islam in the Middle East. They really had extraordinary ambitions to topple governments, say the Saudi government or the government of Egypt, and replace them with governments more along the lines of who was housing them in Afghanistan in those years, the Taliban. But something stood in the way of that grander goal, which was in some ways the United States, because after World War II, the United States was the dominant external factor in the region, and the United States largely stood by governments like Saudi Arabia and Egypt. So, in a twisted sort of way, getting the U.S. out of the Middle East was a primary goal for al-Qaeda and its supporters. Now, how do you do that? Al-Qaeda is a rather small organization, modest military capabilities. Its military really has to use political violence or terrorism, but nothing comparable to the military and economic powers of the U.S. So bear with me for just a moment and give this some thought. Mm-hmm. What if the U.S., after 9/11, took actions that actually weakened the American position in the U.S.? What if the U.S. itself took actions that in some ways would facilitate Osama bin Laden's long-term goal? So you could say in this way, 9/11 was designed to draw the U.S. into the Middle East in a way that could produce negative outcomes for the U.S. And I would say that that is almost exactly what happened. The first initiative was Afghanistan. And I would tell you, Chris, it almost didn't matter who was in the White House on 9/11. Had it been Al Gore or George Bush, the Al-Qaeda and the Taliban was toast. There was no, every American government would have basically done what the United States did in those first few weeks and early months of toppling the Taliban and doing a body blow to Al-Qaeda. But the U.S. stayed in, as we know, for the next 20 years. The U.S. stayed in and tried to basically nation build in a country that could never have achieved the aims of the goals that the Western community had. Also, in those early months, the United States, as it engaged Afghanistan, engaged a wider war on terror and used many tactics that became quite unpopular in many corners of the world. And, I'm talking about the various tortures, the prisons, and so you had the U.S. taking actions that became very unpopular in many cases. But the failure in Afghanistan is almost, I don't know, perhaps it's overshadowed by Iraq. That was a body blow that the United States really did to itself. I don't consider that. I suppose there's obviously what I'm saying some people will disagree with, and that's great for debate. But many people looking back on the U.S. invasion of Iraq see it as a calamity on the scale of Vietnam. So I'll be brief, Chris. I'll bring you in. Both of these policy failures also cause huge rifts with the United States and its allies. The Western European allies are some of our closest allies. The Germans, the British, had huge conflicts with the U.S. here. And then as those 20 years moved on, we saw more conflicts in the Middle East, Syria, Libya, and Yemen. And the U.S. really did not have effective engagement in those conflicts. You could not really point to successes. And then, of course, you had the Arab Spring, which young people were rising up throughout the Middle East, talking about democracy, talking about changes of these authoritarian regimes. And again, the U.S. had a very modest role to play. So I suppose the big picture, obviously, I'm not painting a very nice picture, is that after 20 years, the U.S. finds itself in a lessened position and a weakened position, not just in the Middle East, but not in a terribly strong position globally.
Do you think that in light of what has recently happened with the withdrawal of American troops from Afghanistan, and even though they were successful in killing Osama bin Laden, his popularity, and certainly in Pakistan and probably other parts of the world as well, has grown over time. Some people consider him a hero in a way, even though he's a dead hero in this case. That this is all having to show that what we learned or tried to learn 20 years ago may have been for naught?
Well, honestly, Chris, I wish we had learned from Vietnam. Because so many of the initiatives and frankly the hubris of American foreign policy decision making was all laid out over two decades in Vietnam. as well. And so, sadly, we see to a degree history repeating itself. You know, you also have, Chris, during these years, just frankly, radical swings in the White House, going from George W. Bush to Barack Obama to Donald Trump and now to Joe Biden. Again, such radically different presidencies that have shaken, in many ways, the credibility or leadership ability of the U.S. Because nations historically, particularly after the United States, look to the U.S. for leadership and a pretty predictable degree of stability about how it would conduct itself. And so 20 years later, we don't have that reputation. We have serious economic problems. We are not seen as a leader in climate change. In fact, we're probably seen as one of the states holding back positive change. We'll see where President Biden takes the nation. We have a rise of the Chinese power. We have, frankly, a political system that is not the envy of the world. So I wish I could paint, a brighter picture, but we have a lot of work to do and a lot of reflection to do, actually might be the better thought during this 20-year anniversary, about creating a different trajectory for the role of America in the world.
Do you think, Professor Rupp, that this is not a good time, although we should be remembering the 20th anniversary of a very serious national and international tragedy, but we shouldn't be, thinking too maudlin about it, that we should be trying to do a more reasoned study of what happened and to be able to not do the same thing again in the future?
Well, I think you have a number of guests that you're going to be talking to on this series, Chris, and so I just wanted to bring in this perspective from a guy who focuses on the big picture of international politics. Because if you were talking to Richard Rupp, just the U.S. citizen, I was only about 20 feet away from where I'm currently sitting in my office at Purdue Northwest 20 years ago when we watched the horrors of that day. So that's a whole different conversation as far as those sort of reflections. But I think it's essential that the country be having them. You know, I'm back in the classroom this semester, and most of my students were not born yet. 9/11 was defining in our lives, but it's now a part of history, but it's history with a real lasting impact.
Now, knowing the fact that you're back in the classroom talking with students, I'm sure this is a topic, and because of the fact that it's the 20th anniversary, it's up for reflection by some. Is it more difficult to talk about the events that happened 20 years ago, knowing that the students weren't around at the time to truly understand what it is like now?
Well, it's an interesting question. I mean, I remember that those first weeks being in the classroom and being just stunned and trying to provide some historical context and political context, but also being a very real human being with family in New York, and so students watching that, I think what I was trying to do in those years was to try to give the students some sense of historical context, because their lives changed rather radically. For those students or that generation, that really was the signal event in American foreign policy in their lives. Just like right now, these students, the signal event in America is the pandemic. These students that I have right now, what they've been through the last 2 years will really play a defining role in so much of the rest of their lives, how they think about finances, how they think about jobs, how they think about relationships. So these are the big events in a nation's life that we really need to take stock of and think about.
So you think that basically that it is wise to, of course, to commemorate the 20th anniversary of 9/11, but we have to keep a level head about it all and look to not only today but to the future as well. And that may include not only the pandemic, but it may include some of the more current political events that have happened overseas, and in particular in that region where that American troops had sought out Osama bin Laden.
Couldn't agree more.
Well, Professor Rupp, thank you for your observations, your insight, and thinking about what had happened 20 years ago as the planes crashed into the World Trade Center and into the Pentagon and into a field out in Pennsylvania, and the aftermath of that, of course, as well as a look to trying to learn from the lessons of 9/11 and in the hopes of not letting things like that happen again. Professor Richard Rupp is an associate professor of political science at Purdue University Northwest, and thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you so much, Chris.
Continuing with our special on the 20th anniversary of 9/11, here's Indiana Public Broadcasting's Eric Weddle.
9/11 is a defining day for generations of Americans who remember vividly where they were when the Twin Towers fell. But today's students were born years after the terrorist attacks. From WFYI's Education Desk, reporter Dylan Piers McCoy spoke with an Indiana history teacher about how he revisits 9/11 with high schoolers. Bob DeRuntz has taught U.S. and world history at Chesterton High School for 27 years.
Let's go all the way back to 9/11. What was that day like for you as a teacher?
That day started that morning when a teacher who teaches next to me stuck her head in the classroom and she told me to turn on the television. So I turned on the TV and we all saw one of the Twin Towers was already, you know, a raging inferno. One of the planes had already struck. So much like everybody else in the country, we didn't know if it was an accident. And then we all watched together live as that second plane flew into the second tower. And it was one of those days, you know, I didn't teach another thing all day. You know, we thought about sending the students home, but for the young kids, there was nobody home there to receive them. So students stayed in school, and all day I didn't teach another thing as they went from class to class and we watched.
How did you discuss 9/11 in your history class in the years immediately after the attack? Is it something that you taught?
You know, for years I didn't. I simply didn't teach 9/11 because we all lived it together. But I came to realize at one point that my students were too young. You know, after years, 4, 5, 6 years went by, I began to realize that they were in elementary school when 9/11 happened, and they certainly weren't sitting in third or fourth grade watching this live on TV. Now I get to this point, my students weren't even alive on 9/11. So as we watch the events unfold in Afghanistan and our withdrawal from Afghanistan, they don't have those connections as to why we went into Afghanistan because of 9/11.
United Flight 93 was hijacked on 9/11, and after passengers attempted to regain control of it, it crashed in a field in Pennsylvania. One of those passengers was Todd Beamer, who was on the phone, and his last recorded words were, "Let's roll." You mentioned you have a plaque of those words on your wall. Do they have significance for your students?
I have a great deal of historical memorabilia in my classroom, so it's a rather small American flag that's framed with the words, "Let's roll," on it. And I had a student come to class and pointed at the wall and asked me about those words, "Let's roll." And I remember standing there sort of stunned that he didn't know what that was in reference to. You know, so many people go to Todd Beamer's name at the memorial because they associate him with those events of the day. And when I realized that my students don't even recognize his name, let alone that term, I knew that I needed to go into a much greater deal of detail about 9/11 in my classes. So in my class now, I spend 2 days teaching it and discussing it, and I show a video from National Geographic called Zero Hour, and it breaks 9/11 down almost by the minute in some cases. And it's very graphic, it's very real, it's very raw, and the kids see things they've never seen before. But you can't understand and appreciate the pain of 9/11 unless you relive it in a way.
Why is it important for students now to understand the emotional experience of going through 9/11?
Because they have to understand the emotional connection that Americans have with that day. because be it the invasion of Afghanistan or the Patriot Act or the TSA and the extent to what we have to do when we take a flight today to, you know, tenuous connections for the justification of the invasion of Iraq, you know, none of this makes any sense unless you know why Americans were in such a painful place where that fear of 9/11 turned into rage for vengeance afterwards, that you can't understand any of that unless you have that emotional connection with that awful day.
That's Mitch Marluga with the Friends of the Veterans Memorial Parkway speaking with Lakeshore Public Radio's Tom Maloney back in November of 2019 about the Middle East Veterans Memorial and the trail here in Northwest Indiana. And that's it for Regionally Speaking in the special edition of 9/11, 20 years later. Our thanks to State Representative Ed Soliday and to Purdue Northwest Political Science Professor Richard Rupp for their comments today in the program. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for being with us. We'll be back with you on Monday.